The reading is Revelation chapter 21. We'll begin in verse 1 of Revelation 21 and read in to verse 5 of chapter 22. The Apostle John records, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away.' And he who sits on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' And he said, 'Write, for these words are faithful and true.' Then he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. Overcomes will inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But for the cowardly and unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death.' Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, 'Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb.' And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, and 3 gates on the north, and 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall. The city is laid out as a square, and its length is as great as the width. And he measured the city with the rod, 1,500 miles. Its length and width and height are all equal. And he measured its wall 72 yards, according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. The material of the wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. The foundation stones of the city wall were adorned with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation stone was jasper, the second, sapphire, the third, chalcedony, the fourth, emerald, the fifth, sardonyx, the sixth, sardius, the seventh, chrysolite, the eighth, beryl, the ninth, topaz, the tenth, chrysoprase, the 11th, jacinth, and the 12th, amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each one of the gates was a single pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. In the daytime, for there will be no night there, its gates will never be closed, and they will bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. And nothing unclean, and no one who practices abomination and lying, shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Then he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb, in the middle of its street. On either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding in its fruit every month. And the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. There will no longer be any curse, and the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his bondservants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. And there will no longer be any night, and they will not have need of the light of a lamp nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God will illumine them, and they will reign forever and ever.
Well, it's really good to be with you today, and I've got a visitor up here with me. Hopefully, it'll be clear. Can everybody hear me? All right. We have a really sweet task this morning because we get to look at one of the great fuels that God gives us for the Christian life. Not long ago, I saw the title of a book that said, the Christian life is a long obedience in one direction. And that really is a good description, a long obedience in one direction. Obviously, there are high marks and there are low spots. But when you think of all that God has been doing from Genesis to Revelation, every chapter in that Bible is leading to a great destination. And God letting us know what that destination is one of the ways that he fuels this morning's obedience. And when God gives us these kinds of things, we want to guard ourselves against thinking that this is something extra. You know, something, if things are really difficult today, well, then we would make use of it. But the fuel that God gives us is essential. So we're going to look at the destination of all that God is doing in the big picture and try to plug our very little lives into that as if you're a believer, the ultimate destination for the Christian. And that's found in Revelation 21 and 22. Now, as we look there, we're looking at two of the last three great scenes in the Bible of God completing a process. Chapter 20, God deals finally, fully, irrevocably, and justly with every expression of sin. So chapter 20 is the judgment. Chapter 21, we find God taking this creation, unmaking it, remaking it, so that it's a home for the believer with Christ forever. And chapter 21 and 22 together describe the beauty of the completed church or the completed family of God. When we're on a long journey, we tend to think of it breaking it up in, like legs of a journey. So my wife and I and Sarah, we came from just south of Memphis. We drove here. We got here on Friday. I had to go to North Carolina Saturday morning to speak and then back here. And so in my mind, this is quite relevant. You know, we have all these legs of the journey. When you're on a long journey, if the destination is known, what kind of destination is ahead of you affects how you view each leg of the journey. So if it's a really sweet destination, if you're driving to a graduation, if you're driving to see friends or family that you haven't seen, then even though there are many legs in the journey, they are affected by the awareness of what's ahead. If the journey's destination is bitter and sad, then every leg of the journey is affected. So if it's a happy destination, even the difficult parts of the journey are made sweet. If it's a sad destination, even what would have been happy parts of the journey, you know, beautiful stretches are made bitter. In chapter 21 and 22, God gives us the picture of the destination to fuel the daily obedience of the Christian. But not only do we have this picture so as to make a Christian a prisoner of hope, you know, to draw us on. But if we understand these pictures of the ultimate end of this creation and of the bride of Christ, then we do also have the knowledge that we need to really think more clearly about each leg of the journey. So while we read the Bible and we look at the great events like creation or God calling a people to himself through Abraham, or we see the coming of the Messiah at Bethlehem, God and man in one. Whether we look at all the work of the Lord Jesus Christ or the death or the resurrection or the ascension and the enthronement, all of those legs of the journey in themselves are glorious. But if we see them as leading to something even greater, then each of them are in our minds, you know, greatly enlarged in our own appreciation of them. For example, how would each of those be viewed by you if there were no Revelation 21 and 22? What if the church was never made complete? What if the bride was never gathered, never perfected, and that the best that Christianity gets is what you see in the mirror this morning? And what if this creation just continues in the way that it is? And what if sin is never dealt with? So seeing the destination ought to not only give us hope that fuels obedience this morning, but it ought to help us to get a greater appreciation for everything that God has done in the great scheme of redemption. Now, we're going to be looking at this in Revelation. So obviously, you understand that Revelation is pretty unique. What you have here is theology, biblical theology. Now, but it's presented in sights and sounds. So in a sense, it's not a logically laid out letter like Ephesians. It's almost like walking into the greatest cinema or theater ever. And you walk in and suddenly there are these shocking sights and sounds. And then you walk out and you can never quite shake loose what you saw and heard. But it is biblical theology. In other words, if you study the book of Revelation and you come up with an idea or a set of ideas that are not already present in Genesis through Jude, then you probably have misunderstood the symbols of Revelation. Second thing before we look at it, the symbols are not exaggerations. God is not using hyperbole like we do to make a point. So God is not giving you these shocking, wonder-filled pictures, and then it's to get your attention, but you need to understand that the reality is not going to be quite that great. It's actually the opposite. The things that God describes here through these symbols and these sights that John records, the realities will one day make the symbols appear drab and small and insufficient. After all, how could any man take his pen, even the Apostle John, and communicate to us the realities of hell? How could anyone communicate what the new world will be like, or what the Christian will look like, and describe the joys of the church gathered with God in perfection? So we're looking at symbols of the great end of the church and her new home. Well, let's just jump in and look at that. First, in chapter 21, we read that John describes the new home. And it's described as a new creation, but let me just start right there. There are different ways to use this Greek word, new. So there is the idea of completely new. So completely different from this creation, absolutely unlike this creation, new. Or this creation, but made so much better, elevated, glorified by God, that what results is new. It's the second idea that we want here. And there are some important points about that. But let me just give as an example, maybe a parallel that will help us with this. When we think of the glorified body of Jesus Christ, or the glorified body of a believer in eternity, think of the body of Jesus Christ. Was it a completely different body? Well, no, because we know that he was recognizable and there were still the scars. And yet it was a body that had been glorified or elevated or refashioned in a sense. So it was the old body made infinitely greater. And we see even in the small accounts where Christ meets with the disciples after the resurrection, that his body has abilities that it did not have before. And so will every Christian's body. These bodies will be called from the dust of a grave. and they will be brought before God, brought back together. And as Christ is gathered with his church at the end of time, and he receives his everlasting and infinite glory, he shares this with the church, and we are glorified, and these bodies are transformed to be able to endure a timeless eternity and to enjoy its superior pleasures. But it's the same body. When we think of the creation, it will be this creation, but made so much greater, so much better, better than Eden ever was before sin, that it's new. Two practical points. First, I don't know about you, but generally when I have heard about heavenly, you know, eternal things growing up, I just assumed that I would be there. For first of all, don't know why the way I behaved, don't know why anybody thought I would be there, but I thought I would be there, and I thought I would be floating as some kind of spiritual thing in a spiritual realm with no physicality, nothing like this at all, and I would just be in this kind of cloud of glory with a harp. But that is not where the believer is headed. Now, I often cannot recommend things that C.S. Lewis writes. There are things that he writes that are wrong. But some of the things he writes, and I think it's just really perceptive, but his picture of the new creation in the Chronicles of Narnia, I happen to think it's really helpful. So there are mountains there, rivers, you know, oceans, whatever, like this, and yet so unlike this. Mountains infinitely higher, rivers sweeter, colors brighter. In the new creation, you will not have an immaterial existence where you float in a blob of glory. It will be in a new home, a new refashioned universe like this, but infinitely better. Second, when we think of the new creation being this creation, unmade and remade, it is a wonderful picture of the triumph of Jesus Christ. Think about your body. Your body has been used, this body has been used to serve self. This body has been so long under the lies of sin. And even as a Christian brought to the Lord 32 years ago, my body has since then still at times become an instrument of selfishness. Is this body going to be a trophy of sin and Satan forever and ever because God will just say, well, that body's pretty much shot. Let's just start over with a new body. No. This body is included in the great redemption of Christ. This body, which once served self, will forever and ever be a trophy of Christ's indescribably great love. And it's the same thing with the creation. Do you remember what Paul says about this creation in Romans 8? He describes it in a very personified way, and he says this: for the anxious longing of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God, for your completion. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him, God, who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. So think about it. This creation, which has suffered for thousands of years under the weight of our rebellion against God, will be rescued in the great end of redemption and remade perfect. And it will be dedicated to the pleasure of Christ and his people. It will be consecrated to the church forever and ever. And never again will it groan under the weight of one wrong thought or one wrong deed. And the new creation will be, therefore, an everlasting mockery of sin's lies. Snatched from the hand of the enemy, it will be made the trophy of the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, let's look at it. This new home, this new creation, what will it be and why is it so great? And he starts strangely by describing what it's not, okay? So I know that you're building a new building. I got to see it yesterday. And, you know, I've been here a few times as it's progressing along. Very exciting. If you were to tell somebody, our new church building is going to be so great. I mean, we just can't wait. You probably, if they said, well, I mean, what's it like? You probably would not start where John starts. Let me tell you what it doesn't have. But that's where John starts. The new creation. Oh, it's indescribably sweet. Let me tell you what it doesn't have. But how else would you describe it? How could you describe what it does have? So John starts under God's direction by telling you what it doesn't have. First of all, it does not have the sea or the ocean. And that's a little strange. A few weeks ago, my family and I, we got to go spend some time on the beach with my wife's family. We like the sea. Why is there no sea in the future? Well, this is symbolic, all right? So I don't want you to imagine a planet Earth that's extremely dry. But the point in Revelation is this. All the tumult and the chaos and the danger that arises from mankind's rebellion against God cannot be in the new home. It is a home without possibility of strife. Now, in the book of Revelation, the sea is generally a picture of that great rebellion against God and all that chaotic turmoil. So in chapter 13 of Revelation, we see that the beast, this symbol of the world's powers aligned against God, the beast comes out of the sea. The only time we see the sea there in a pleasant way is in chapter 4, when John is describing the glory of God and the throne of the Father and the Son, and that throne is described as seated right in front of a sea as if made of glass, so perfectly stilled. It's a wonderful picture. Through the rule of Christ, all the turmoil is settled and peace reigns. In the new creation, every aspect of sins rising up in rage against God's rights will be absent. And that's why it will be so wonderful. Then he says, the first things will not be there. In Revelation 21, verse 4, he gives a long list. And then he says, now these are the first things. And the first things won't be there. So things that belong to the first order, to this existence. And he gives us a list. And this is a list that we're pretty familiar with. He says that there will be no more tears, no more death, no more sorrow, no more pain. Now, these all entered in the first order. When? When Adam hoped to open the door to sin's lies and let in just a few things, right? Adam, you can be like God. What an enticing drug to humanity. You can have godlike rights, godlike privileges, godlike abilities. We've all lived for that. Adam tries to open the door a few inches and let that in. But anytime sin is invited in, it brings all of its ugly cousins. And so everything else comes in too. Sorrow, death, pain. In the new creation, none of these are possible because no sin is left. But notice the description there. It is not merely the automatic outcome of Christ's victory over sin in chapter 20 that means that no sorrow can exist for the believer in chapter 21. It is not just the outcome of his victory. It is the very personal determination of the triune God that he himself will see to it that it is impossible for sorrow and heartbreak and pain and tears to exist. It's one thing to be told that you would be able to go somewhere where there would be no sorrow. That is unimaginably good. But it's quite a sweeter thing to say you're going to go somewhere where there cannot be any sorrow because the one that is there with you prevents it. Then he describes who's not going to be there. There are times, sadly, where very pleasant situations are made very unpleasant by the group of people that joined you there. So, you know, you go to this resort, you know, you go on vacation, and you arrive, and it's as beautiful as the internet pictures promised. And as soon as you get there, you meet other people, you know, and maybe they're loud. Maybe they're drunk. And you think, you know what? This would be a nice place if no humans were here. In the new home, there are people that will not be allowed to be there. And it is part of its infinite happiness. He gives a list in verse 8. And really, a lot of the list, you know, we would have written, but some of the things maybe we wouldn't, like liars, cowards, and unbelievers. And these will be with the others in an everlasting judgment. But think of this spiritually. Those whose lives are characterized, it's not saying you ever lied. I mean, no one would be in heaven. These are descriptions of you as a general pattern. If you could be identified as a person who, as a basic rule, you practice spiritual self-deceit and you wear a mask with other people so as to present a wrong idea of where you're at. If you lie to yourself spiritually, you will not be in this home. Cowards. If you're the kind of person that says to Jesus Christ quietly after a Bible reading or a sermon, God, I wish to have what was just described, but God, I can't because, and then some fear rises up in your heart. I would, but you will not be in this home. An unbeliever, a person that says, I want to believe God, but I just can't seem to bring myself to believe God. We often treat unbelief as if it's kind of a natural detriment. Like, well, it's just the way I am. I have a hard time believing or trusting. Well, that would be a good excuse if God had not demonstrated himself thousands of times to you, to have always told you the truth. And sin and selfishness, which you believe every morning, has always lied to you. So for us, not to believe God, it's not just a shortcoming. It's a willful choice. Now, we find two more things that won't be here that also we would not have expected. When Anthony read, did you notice? No church buildings and no sun or moon or stars. No physical light, no church buildings. This is symbolic. But think about it. In the perfect creation where God dwells among his people, the building of a church or a prayer chapel or a temple is completely redundant. It's obsolete. God himself forms the environment of the believer. Nothing between you and your Lord. An intimacy, and we're going to see this when he describes the happiness of the bride and not just of the new creation. But the intimacy that the bride has with the Redeemer is such that no building is necessary. And no light, because he is the light. Again, it's symbolic. All that light is to us, light is life and warmth and safety and joy, and darkness is danger and death and gloom. All that we think of that comes with light comes with Christ. He will be there. Well, that's the new creation. Now let's look at the bride. Verse 9. It says that the angel, one of the angels that held one of the seven bowls full of judgment that were poured out on the earth earlier, one of those angels came and said to John, come with me and I will show you the bride. Then verse 10 says, I saw a city. Which is it? Well, it's a bride. But her beauty will be described to you through symbols that are fitting to a city. Perhaps God uses this because of the collective quality of the bride. It's not one really beautiful woman that has been made beautiful by the kindness of God. It is a company of people that no man can number from every generation and every corner of the planet. So here's this great company that collectively is the family of God or the bride of Christ. And so we see her pictured through symbols of a city. Before we get there, one of the sweetest things about this passage in my mind is one that isn't so easily seen unless you've been reading Revelation. Revelation chapter 17, verse 1 begins just like Revelation 21, verse 9. It says, then an angel, one of the angels that held one of the seven bowls full of judgment, came to John and said, come with me, I will show you a woman. A few chapters later, same exact event, same wording, come with me, this angel from the judgment, come with me, I will show you the bride. Now, the reason it is so wonderful is before you look at the beauty of the completed Christian, before you look at the beauty of the completed church, you are going to be, in chapter 17, you are looking at the sensual, exciting appearance of man-made religion. And you get to see how ugly she is compared to the bride of Christ. In chapter 17, we're introduced to a woman who looks beautiful. She's there. All the kings of the world seem to be in love with her. All the nations come to her. She's so popular. She's a prostitute. She's dressed beautifully, covered in the most expensive jewelry. In her hand is a cup made of gold. Surely you think whatever's in that cup is great. And she gives it to anyone that wants it. In fact, it seems like the whole planet goes and drinks it. But in the cup is destruction. Now, later the woman is described. So she's described as a harlot or a prostitute. And later she's described as a city, Babylon. If you read any of the old reformers, they often compare this to the Roman Catholic Church. This is the great harlot Babylon. This is the Roman Catholic Church. Why would they do that? Actually, I would agree that that's one application, but that's not the big picture. In the book of Revelation, the beast symbolizes the world powers, the governmental powers that hunt and crush the church. But this woman is not the fearsome, terrifying world powers. She is the enticing, alluring, deadly prostitute of religion. Man-made religion, the kind of religion we would make, the kind of religion we were interested in before Christ conquered our hearts. You are either going to go to her or you are going to be a part of the bride. Man-made religion, dangerous. It'll kill you. A religion that's all about you, it's all for you, it's whatever you want. It looks so beautiful, so sensuous, and it kills. Now turn from the ugliness of the best that man-made religion brings, and then turn to the bride and see the descriptions. Well, it says that she is beautiful with the glory of God. Now, when we think of those words, it just turns into Sunday talk, right? It's just so religious. You think, oh yeah, well, glory of God stuff. What does that mean? And John helps us to understand what that means by giving us other examples. But let me say this. No believer that looks in the mirror this morning spiritually and looks into the mirror of the Word of God can ever think, you know, one day if I really try hard, I will make myself so beautiful. I'll be as perfect as this picture. The beauty that the church will bear for endless millennia is not her beauty, but the beauty of her God. And one of the ways that we see that spelled out is in the coming description. First of all, she is described as a jasper stone, a gemstone, and yet crystal clear. Now, the problem is, because this is symbolism, we don't have jasper stones on earth that are crystal clear. They're always colored. In our minds, we would think of a diamond-like stone. Can you imagine the beauty of a person who, instead of being made out of flesh and bones, walked up to you and they were made of some form of diamond, and the sunrise comes up over the horizon and it hits the person and the light is caught and refracted through the thousands of facets of their life, and you cover your face in front of them because it's too brilliant? The bride of Christ will one day bear the beauty of her Lord, and it will be like a diamond-like stone that catches all the light of our sun, and it flows through her in a thousand ways. Also, she's described as being translucent or transparent gold. Gold, this city is made of, but gold that's see-through like glass. Can you imagine a city an enormous city, a New York City, a London, or whatever the biggest city you've been in. Cities are not my favorite places, you know, to stay very long. It's just so crowded. But can you imagine a city with all of its skyscrapers and every aspect of that city is built with a translucent or a transparent gold, and the streets are of the same thing, and every blade of grass and tree and every park and every bench and every car is made of the same thing. And then you take our sun in the sky and you plant it into the heart of the city, and how it would be blindingly beautiful as the city is illuminated with the energy of the sun, a transparent gold. And that is an understatement of the beauty of the Christian. Now, let's stop and be honest. John the Apostle has never seen the church of Jesus Christ look this way at this point in his life. He's been a pastor. He pastored at Ephesus. But read the letter he wrote to Ephesus in Revelation. Ephesus is not that beautiful. John is the penman for Christ when he sends seven letters to the churches, and the great majority of these letters contain rebukes. So Christ will say, yes, you are my people, but there are some really ugly spots. John has never seen a Christian perfected. John has never seen a church finished. So all of this is the first time for John, just like it's the first time for us, to try to understand the beauty of the completed people of God. I mentioned that it's the glory of the Lord. Did you catch the reference to jasper there? In chapter 4, when John first sees the glory of God on the throne, and he describes all of that, he describes the outshining of God's worth, that glory, as being like a stone, a jasper. Was that it? If I open my Bible, it'll fly over and hit you, all right? The same stone, the jasper stone, crystal clear. The words John uses to describe the brilliance emanating from the throne of God in chapter 4 is the same words that he uses to describe the beauty of the church. Now, that's her. And my iPad just died on me. All right, let me get it back to life. She bears the beauty of her Lord. Let's go on. Look at the size of the city. The size of the city is 1,500 miles wide, 1,500 miles long. So 1,500 miles wide and long, and it's the shape of a square, and that comes out to, if my calculator's right, 2,250,000 square miles. Take every great city that has ever been built and forgotten on planet Earth, and every great city that exists today, and put them together, and you will not have a city that is 2,250,000 square miles. But then it says this city also goes up 1,500 square miles, which puts us in the 3-point-something billion zone. What's the point of this? Is the bride a square that is 3-point-some billion miles big? No. The gathered people of Christ are innumerable. I know it's easy to look at the news and to think, you know, when you look at the world, it seems that so few people even know the true gospel. And so few people even in religion seem to love the true Christ. That I think if I were writing Revelation, I would say, and John turned and saw the bride, and there is this perfectly beautiful little town. And you look at the doctrine of election, and the enemy says to you, well, it's true, God has a right to make some choices in eternity past. But you understand that God is stingy, and it's only going to be a little bit of group, the small and despised church. The church can feel small and despised today. But do not let that fashion in your mind small expectations. The hope that fuels obedience today includes a gathering of a people that no man can number, a 3-point-some-billion cubic mile town. Next, it describes her safety. The safety of the bride is described as because she's a city with a giant wall around her, and each of the four sides of the wall has a gate in it, three gates on each side, and each of the gates has an angel by it. Now, in the ancient world, gates to walled cities. It was the only way for you to be safe. Some, you know, there are still cities in the world you can visit, and it still has a wall around it. York, England, has a wall around it. The gates would be there, and they would always be open in the daytime so people could come and go to the city and commerce and travel. But at nighttime, the gate would be closed. I was reading recently in Hudson Taylor's biography where, you know, he was a missionary, but he's also a doctor. And he received word that one of the missionaries in a city that they were working in, one of the missionaries was very ill, and they needed Hudson Taylor to come back immediately from his evangelistic trip and try to rescue the guy. And so Taylor gets the message. He turns and he journeys back to the city. And though he tries very hard, he gets there just in time as night is falling to see the gates shut and locked. Nobody gets in. A government official shows up right behind him, and they will not open the gates for a government official. He actually did get in the city. They did have a provision for this. They lowered down a basket with ropes, and the government official, who had official documents that needed to get there that day, was put in the basket and pulled up. Now, they would not have pulled up a British missionary. So Hudson Taylor grabbed the ropes, and when they pulled him up, they found they had a government official in the big basket and an English missionary hanging onto the ropes. And he said that the only reason that they let him in the city was he gave them 200 good reasons, $200, and they let him in, and he was able to help the man. The ancient cities locked their gates at night for protection. This city, it says, the gates never close. Why? Because there's never a nighttime. Now, the point here is this. The happiness, we're not talking about a city, but a person. The happiness of the people of Christ is a secure happiness. No matter how beautiful the descriptions are of your happiness, if it was a fragile happiness, how much would it be worth to you? Happinesses on planet Earth are always mixed, aren't they? You go to the birth of a baby, and you know, it's a grandchild or a child, and it's so exciting, and everybody's there, and you're happy. But how long until you wonder, is the baby really healthy? Will the family be okay? Will that child grow up and love the Lord, or grow up and break its parents' hearts? We go to an event, and it's happy. And let's say there's nothing that spoils it at all. It's just perfect. But in your mind, there's the haunting reality that this is limited. We'll have to leave. We'll have to go back to normal life. When we describe the happinesses of the completed people of God in the future, they are perfectly protected happinesses. No haunting fear of limitation. No fear that things would change, because no enemy will ever enter and alter the situation. Now, what's in it? In the bride, there is a throne manifested, and from the throne, there is a crystal clear spring, and there is a road that leads from the throne to the house of every believer of this bride, and there is a tree growing by the river. What is all of that? Chapter 22 describes this, and I think that if we were to kind of just keep the big picture and not take time to go through every one of them carefully, what do we have? The happiness of the Christian in eternity future, the happiness of every Christian, is described like this. Imagine you lived in a perfect place, and your house was on a street that went directly to the throne of the King. Instant access. Always access. He is your father. You don't live somewhere in the city, and it takes a long time to get there, and you have to go through a number of, you know, blocks. Your home is on a road that is directly connected to the King's rule. Your home, outside of your home, this street is lined by a river of life. And by this river of life is a tree that brings life. And so you can go and eat as many times as you want, and there is satisfaction, and there's a reason for life, and there's healing in the leaves. And all of this is rooted in what? In the fact that God perfectly rules in the heart of the believer in eternity. Again, we're not talking about a city. We're talking about a person. The perfect, unrivaled rule of Jesus Christ in every glad heart in eternity. will provide us such an intimacy with our Lord Jesus Christ that it's like having a river of life and a tree of life that constantly feeds and satisfies us. Well, there's a picture of the bride, and it does take a stretch of our imagination, but it's not something that we can't apply. So let me give you a couple of just basic applications. First of all, when we look at all these unusual pictures, what are we really looking at? Well, really, we're just looking at a pictorial display of what Paul says in Ephesians 2. Do you remember that in Ephesians 2, Paul turns to what God is doing in you and for you, and how that is a picture of his glory? Listen to what he says. But God, being rich in mercy, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you've been saved. And raised us up with him, and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. So that, here's the purpose, in the ages to come, he might show the surpassing riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. Revelation 21 and 22 is Ephesians 2, verse 7, given, drawn out in front of our eyes in pictures. Second, how do you live on this in a way that has any practical value? It is a gift from the Lord. But it is not a gift like the kind of gifts we give. Now, I don't know when the last time you got a really, really nice gift. You know, the kind of gift that when it's given to you, you're almost embarrassed by its generosity. You know, the sacrifice that the person went to give this to you, the thoughtfulness, the planning, the time it took, and they hand it to you, you know, and you look at it and you're just, you kind of don't even know what to say. It's too nice. It's too good. It costs too much. And then there are gifts that are just happies. That's what we call them in Mississippi. Little things that people give you. It's kind of thoughtful, but really it's junk, you know, and it just clutters my car. Don't ever give me a happy. I just despise those things. They end up on eBay, really, but anyway. Whatever gift we're talking about, the little thing that just, you know, hey, you know, it just cost a couple dollars, I thought of you, or the really expensive, shockingly sacrificial gift. Generally with us, gifts are things that are extras. Wonderful or not, they're extras. Gifts are not life and death. I've never gotten up on Christmas morning, run out and opened my presents and said, I can make it another year because this is life and death. Now, your kids may think it's life and death, but it's not really life and death. Gifts are extra, not essential. In chapter 1 of Revelation, it says that this revelation, this unveiling of Jesus Christ, which the whole book is, this unveiling of Jesus Christ was given by the Father to his eternal Son, the God-man, so that the Son could give it to his church. Listen, it's great to have something wonderful, but it's so much sweeter when you realize what motivated it. The love of God the Father for his Son moves him to give this unveiling of what's coming. And the love of the Father and the Son together move them to give it to the church, the servants, the ones that are surrounded by enemies, the ones that have a long journey to go, the ones that it feels like the sun is setting so quickly. Even though Revelation 21 and 22 give us marvelous pictures of what's ahead of the destination, if you think of this gift as a non-essential extra, you are mistaken. You will never, as a church, really live the way you ought to live for the glory of Christ, if in some measure these realities don't grip you. And it's the same for the individual Christian. We need this gift for service. So like Abraham, we may live our entire life here seeing very little or nothing of this, but living on these realities because the one that told us it cannot lie. Another application. When you look in the mirror as a believer and your heart is somewhat broken by the fact that you still see so much of you and so little of Jesus Christ, and now that you're a Christian, That's a serious matter. Can you read Revelation 21 and 22? And can you see yourself in the ultimate end and goal of the church? And can you hold to the course and not lie down in self-pity and be paralyzed by despair? Yes, I mean, we can find enough in us to fill many prayer meetings with complaining. But it is not humility to lay down in the dirt and tell the king we're so bad. Humility comes to God and says, I indeed, but Christ. And God, by your grace, I trust that this is not just fiction. And I will get up and I will live with him and by him and for him today. So the destination alters every step of the journey for you. Another application. You have never seen a Christian look like this, like John had never. And you might see Christians in your church right now, in your home, that break your heart. I'm not talking about being legalistic and the arrogance that rises up in the Pharisee's heart. I mean a real heartbrokenness. And you see people that you know belong to Christ as far as we can know. And you know they love Christ. But the enemy has taken them, you know, just slightly off course. And they seem to be slowly drifting. And you say, you know, gentle things to them to allure them back to Christ. And they seem deaf. And you wonder, God, what will be the end of these choices? And you're ready to despair and to give up on Christianity or to give up on church. Can you not see the Christian sitting next to you Sunday morning or across from you at breakfast table tomorrow morning? Can you not see them in light of Revelation 21 and 22? And instead of despairing, let hope move you to really plead with the Lord for their souls and to look for opportunities to say words that might bring them back. How do you know if you're in this company? I mean, you're here in this gathering, but that doesn't mean you're going to be here in Revelation 21 and 22. That doesn't mean that these are your happinesses and this is your new home. So let's be very honest. How do you know you're here? Well, there are two descriptions of the believer prior to their completion in this passage. In chapter 21, verse 8, it describes who won't be there. Do you remember? But in chapter 21, verse 6, and chapter 21, verse 7, there are two phrases that describe the believer prior to the great wedding day with Christ, prior to her completion. Do you ever read, you know, you go back, if you've been alive long enough to have, you know, 10-year anniversaries, 20-year anniversaries, 30-year anniversaries, and more, of graduations or whatever. And you read some names on a list of people that you went to school with, and you don't recognize some of the names because they've all gotten married. So you say, I knew a girl named Jenny, but it wasn't Jenny this, it was Jenny that. And your wife says to you, no, that's her married name. That's Jenny so-and-so. And she tells you her maiden name, and you go, oh yeah, no, I know Jenny so-and-so. What is the maiden name of the bride of Christ? I mean, we're not glorified yet, so maybe you don't recognize yourself. But your maiden name is here, the name you bear now. Two descriptions. The maiden name of the bride is thirsty and overcomer. Have you found yourself by the mighty work of God, stripping away all the things that satisfied you? Have you found yourself to come to a place of such agonizing thirst that only Christ could satisfy? Could you ever be called the thirsty one that Christ gave living water to? Now, it's a different thing than being dry. Now, we're out here today, and there's probably plenty of allergies floating around, and some of you will be coughing and drinking. And you ever have a dry throat? You go to bed, you think, I'm kind of thirsty, but I'm not thirsty enough to get out of bed, so I'll just wait. Are you that way spiritually? I'm a little dry. Life's a little irritating. I mean, it just doesn't seem to satisfy. Run to the fountain. No, I'm not that dry. Some other day. Thirsty. Second description, overcomer. When Christ conquers us by his love and makes us alive, opens our eyes, frees our heart to love what's really beautiful, breaks the chain on our will so we can cheerfully consecrate ourselves to the service of Jesus Christ, even with all our imperfections and stumblings, you must be described as an overcomer. By the grace of Christ, I can no longer be distinguished by a ceasefire with sin, a truce. Is that you? Are you a person who has decided that certain not so embarrassing sins can live unmolested in your heart, protected against God? If you're okay with that, this is not you. But if by the grace of God, the thing you hate most now is that you still can sin against him, and by the grace of God, you lay hold of all that he provides to day by day progressively lay those old enemies at the feet of Jesus Christ, you are an overcomer. That's the maiden name of the bride. Last application. Is this a picture of the future of the church? Yes. Is it only a picture of the future of the church? No. Paul wrote to the Ephesians and said that when God saved you and he gave you his Spirit, the Spirit of God was entrusted with giving you the earnest or the down payment of what is yet to come in the fullness of the new covenant completed. What we have here is reflected in full here in this passage. So, do you not recognize these things, Christian? You could just go through them. Do you not recognize that God has made you safe with the wall of covenant, of promises, of his faithfulness? There's a wall around you now. It's not 217 foot tall with pearl gates and angels, but it's there. Do you not recognize that he is beginning to make you beautiful, not with you becoming a better you using God, but God forming Christ in you? 2 Corinthians chapter 3, looking unto Jesus, you are changed from glory to glory, from one level of Christlikeness to the next. Do you not see, if you're honest, that there is something of the qualities and the fruit of the Spirit, something of the moral beauty of Jesus is starting to take root in you, in your desires, in your words and actions? Are you not, honestly, are you not starting to see God turn you from this kind of, you know, animated carbon dust into the diamond-like, gold-like city, that as you open your heart to Christ together each week, or as you open it to God with an, you know, before the scriptures each day, it's as if the beauty of Christ is absorbed and in some little way reflected? You can go through all these descriptions of the bride and her privileges, and you can find that actually they've started already. So my question to you is this: how much do you have? I mean, everybody has, you know, subjectively, greater or lesser experiences. How much of that beauty of Christ? How much of that security? You know, how much of that happy, satisfying rule of the throne of Christ and the river that comes from it? Will you not, for God's honor, plead with him that however far you've progressed, that you would not stop here as a church, as an individual, and that you would press on to see how much of the down payment can a believer have here? For Christ's honor, let's pray. God, we thank you that in this long journey in one direction, this long obedience, you have given us plenty of fuel. We thank you for hope, and we ask that you would make us prisoners of these realities, that they would grasp us, that before our feet hit the floor tomorrow morning as we're getting out of bed, the realities of what is yet to come would captivate our souls. and would change the way we travel. For the honor of Jesus Christ, we ask it.